So, hey, everybody, good morning. This is Eric Mann with Channing Martinez. You're on Voices from the Frontlines, your national movement building show. And today we always say we have a great show because Channing and I get very excited about it, but we're really happy to be talking to, and yes, the great Ken Loach, who is just such a brilliant filmmaker. And I'm calling this your next to last film, Ken, because you never know. I want to keep your options open. So we're going to talk about his wonderful film, The Old Oak, which will be playing at a sneak preview at Stratton Soul Movement Center on Thursday, April 11th. Then it opens on Friday at the Lemley Royal on the 12th. And we're really excited to have both. Ken, if you could say again what you said off the record about how you understood the review, because I want to talk to you about it.
Eric, you very kindly wrote a review of the film Sorry We Missed You, which was the film you made before The Old Oak. And it's about what we call the gig economy, where permanent jobs became casualized, and it's about a family, a delivery driver, who is not employed by the firm he's working for, but becomes an independent contractor, responsible for his own van, responsible for everything. And if he doesn't turn up for work, he'll get fined because he's made the contract to deliver that day's work as an independent contractor. And his wife, who is a care worker, again, casualized. And it's about the conditions, how the conditions of their separate jobs impact on the lives of the family. Because as we all know, when you go to work, you put on a face, you put on a smile, but when you get home, then the exhaustion, the time you're away kicks in, and the prospect of having a life of dignity with time to spend with your kids just goes, and you're struggling, still struggling to put bread on the table. And that's what the film's about. And you wrote a very kind review, Eric, if I may say so. And it really saw to the heart of what we tried to do.
Well, you know, Ken, when you know, people review my books or something, I always want to know, did they see me? You know what I mean? And so I worked very hard on that review because we have a mutual friend, Emily Russo, from Zeitgeist Films, who is a big fan, and then she says, Eric, you got to do this review, which I did. There's so many scenes before we get to Old Oak about Sorry We Missed You. There's two scenes that were very heartbreaking to me. One is how the protagonist brings his daughter to work and how happy they are. They have a connection, and, you know, it's always great to have a two-person team, and he's running all over the place. And then his boss says, you can't have her on the truck. And that was heartbreaking because they're even increasing productivity, you bastards, you know. And also he has a moment to be with his child and they rule that out of order, which causes, you know, more pain in his family. And yeah. Also the idea of the wife who is so caring about the older women with Alzheimer's and dementia, and how she combs their hair. You know, we know a lot of people who are aging and the wonderful work that people are doing, but no respect for the working class.
Yeah. Yes. Well that's true. I mean, Paul Laverty wrote the script, and if the film belonged to anybody, they belong to the writer, and Paul's a wonderful writer, and we've worked together for 30 years, and it's a real partnership of equals, you know. So I never talk about my film, it's always our films. And I mean, he met many workers, care workers, and so many build relationships with the people they look after. But of course, the the employers, the agencies that employ them, have no regard for that. I guess from their point of view, that it is about making profit from the workers' employment, as always, and so they can't afford to indulge the what they would say is an indulgence for the to always keep the same person going to the same old care again to the same person, so that they can't afford to respect that relationship always. Again, the care worker can be called any time of the day or night. It's part of the deal, but they could, because the old people may need help at any time. So it's a very one-sided job in terms of responsibility and freedom. But it's very poorly paid. I mean, it's on the minimum wage. So, I mean, you make the point in the review, which is a good point, that in order for Ricky, the husband, to do his job, he's got to get a van, he's got to buy one or hire one. That means he's got to get some capital. The only capital they've got is his wife's car. She needs it for her job. But Ricky will earn more as a driver, he thinks, and that will pay off the debt they're already in. So she gives up her car and she depends on buses. It makes her late. Buses are not punctual. They don't turn up. So there's this constant pressure, anxiety, communicated between everyone, and once Ricky is in debt because of the loan he's had to, because of the extra money he's had to get a van, then he's got to keep working whether he's ill or not.
Well, let's keep going, Ken, because I mean, one thing that's great about your work is that you're very committed to the working class and to class politics. I'm later on going to get to Land and Freedom, but I just want to tell you about Land and Freedom, the film you did. You know, I come out of the communist tradition, and I'm still identified overall with the communist world. And we watched Land and Freedom, and there was a woman, Elly Schnitzer, the late Elly Schnitzer, who was also came out of the communist sort of tradition. And we saw the film independently. We didn't know we were going to see each other. So at the end of the film, which is about the Spanish Civil War and the internal fighting between the communists and the anarchists and the loyalists inside, she turned to me and said, "We made some mistakes, huh? So you can't be a better filmmaker to get to communists to think, looking back at the Spanish Civil War, that maybe we made some mistakes." So it's a very thoughtful film in your repertoire. And I just wanted to register how influential it was.
Oh, well, that's very generous. I mean, it's a very interesting story, that. And the, I mean, doing the research on that. And we made it in 95. And we shot it in 95, or was it 94? One or the other. And we met some of the veterans there, met brilliant, brilliant people. A woman who was still working in the market in Barcelona, who was still angry because the women had fought alongside the men when the militia first began, the Citizens' Army. And then at a certain point, the women were told they couldn't fight in the front line. She was still angry that they took her gun away from her, you know, nearly 60 years later. I mean, great people. A man, Juan Rocabert, who lived all his life in France because he couldn't live there under Franco. And he took us to all the battlefields. And the scene at the end where the militia are accused of betraying the revolution, which was sadly not true, and they were forced to put down their arms. And Juan Rocabert was watching that, and that had happened to him. He'd been in that very scene, and he was weeping. He was weeping, and it was an extraordinarily moving moment, really. So it was an extraordinary film to make. But every film's extraordinary, really, Eric and Chummy. I mean, it's because you You meet such amazing people. And what is always strikes us is the openness and the vulnerability and the commitment people show and the tone people show in sharing their stories and creating what is essentially fiction, but making it true, you know, and with an understanding that is always takes your breath away, really.
Well, yes, it's so we're gonna have to get people to so see Sorry to Bother You, see to see Land and Freedom, and we're gonna talk about the Old Oak in a minute. I just want you to know this is my 60th year in the movement. I began in 1964 with the Congress of Racial Equality, and I'm still mad at everything too, so that's sort of part of the job. But I'm working on a book called We Made the Revolution with Our Bodies on the Line. And, we've been attacked by the police. We've been attacked by the COINTELPRO, is called in the United States, the FBI, the CIA. But the sad thing is we turn on each other. And you can't stop some of the external attacks, but the attacks between communists and socialists, between so-called black nationalists and black cultural nationalists. At the Strategy Center, we try so hard to have a non-sectarian approach to the world. But that's one of the sad things about Land and Freedom is these are all amazing people putting their bodies on the line against Nazi Franco, and the
Yes.
internal struggles are heartbreaking.
Yes, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. They are heartbreaking. But I think these, I mean, what is different for the left as opposed to the right, who just have to, you know, keep the status quo is easy. But
Right.
the differences in political analysis in the end are critical, because it's if you get the political analysis right, then you have a path to success. If you get them the lead up to a dead end, then you won't win. And you know, I can understand that, the importance of that. But what I think is so sad is that the left cannot be rational in its understanding of differences in the argument, and allowing the logic of the argument to keep the comrades together. And that's really what we need. I mean, you know, the old difference of, you know, the old ego, it all goes back to Stalin and Trotsky, doesn't it? And the, you know, socialism in one country, and whether and the decision of the Communist Party in Spain, for example, that this was not the time for a social revolution, that it had to be a bourgeois society because they weren't ready for a socialist revolution, as my awful memory seems to remember, and the contrary view from the other side, but the it's the betrayal of good people is what's said. I mean, we're seeing in miniature. I mean, I lived through a lot of sectarianism in the 60s. Of one group fighting another, and we were always told, you know, your biggest enemy was the person closest to you, because if you could defeat them, you got their members, you know, instead of 10, you were 20. And I
That's
mean, it
another
was
thing.
silly, you know. I mean,
Well,
I'm actually challenged. In fact, that our kids were playing football. I mean, they were 6, 7 year olds were playing football with the kids from another rival movement. And the lunacy, I mean, lunacy, you know? One of the things that made me leave some of these small groups, because that's sectarianism at its worst. And we're seeing signs of it now, because the Labour Party is now very much on the right under Keir Starmer. I mean, it is a neoliberal party now, claiming to be the party of Labour. And the left is trying to organize and unite. But we've got some groups are running ahead and saying, we're going to stand in these constituencies, come and support us, march behind our flag. But that won't work, because we need to find, there needs to be agreement between everybody who will stand in the different constituencies. And if one goes ahead, it's like they're trying to build their own version of the left rather than sharing it in a comradely collective fashion. So sadly, sectarianism is alive and kicking.
Well, yeah, it's even in the United States, there's a great movement, and I want to just take a minute on this. There's a great movement among to former revolutionaries to form nonprofits. Now we're a nonprofit too, legally, but we think we're a revolutionary collective. But here you have the absence of politics, but still the sectarianism. The groups are fighting over nothing. In my book, I'm trying to find the areas of greatest unity. Like there was the national mobilization against the war in Vietnam, where all the groups got together and did work together. There was the March on Washington, where all the groups, despite their differences, got together. So I'm also trying to find the model of when difference could be more tolerated and accepted. And really believing in a common enemy. And so let's go to the Old Oak. It's a less explicitly political film than Land and Freedom. And yes, I absolutely know it's Paul Lafferty in your film, and the writing is great, great, great. So tell me, what was the vision for this film? What were you trying to say? And I'll tell you, of course, my thoughts. And Channing has seen it too. We like the film very much. And obviously, we're showing it on Thursday, April 11th at 6 p.m. at the Strategy and Soul Movement Center, 3546 Martin Luther King. Info at thestrategycenter.org, and go online at thestrategycenter.org website and buy a ticket now. So tell us about, since this may be a last film, what was the, between you and Paul as partners, why'd you pick this theme?
Well, we've done three films in the northeast of England, which is an area, very special area, built on the old industries of shipbuilding, steel, and coal mining.
Right.
They've all gone, and coal mining was a political execution, really, of mining by Margaret Thatcher, because the miners had the strongest trade union, the most politicized. They had the strongest communities. Again, politicized, great communities, and the miners had a strength that few industries had, workers in few industries had. Since the mines shut, the villages and mines were mainly in the countryside. There'd be the pit, there'd be terraces of miners' houses, and then the countryside. So there were the image of the mining village is very simple, very clear, and those strong communities gradually disintegrated. No work was went in the place of the mines. Some people left. The infrastructure died. Shops closed. Public spaces disappeared. Churches closed. Some schools closed. Some doctors' surgeries closed. They became desperate. The desperation led a lot to a lot of bitterness and anger. We've been abandoned. But alongside that were the old traditions of solidarity left over from the mining industry, internationalism, and community loyalty and support. And we wondered, how can we tell that story? And then Paul heard the story that more Syrian refugees came to that part of the world, that part of Britain, than any other head part of the country per head of population. More. Why? Because they're out of sight. The press won't write about them. The people can't get organized to come. Of course, they'll complain, but who cares? Nobody will write about it. So that's what happened. And they were met initially with resentment and anger, and it became a breeding ground for racism. And the question was, Well, Paul thought, and we agreed, the intervention of the Syrians clarified the what those mining communities had become, but it also said something about the terrible plight of war, and by implication, though it's not in the film, by implication, the role of countries like Britain
Right.
in wars that generate the refugee crisis, like our and the US's role in the illegal war in Iraq, massive refugee, and again in Afghanistan too, a lot of refugees from Afghanistan and all around that region, for which Britain plays has some responsibility. So that's where it began. That's where it began.
Yeah, and I think the thing, and I wish you had put a little bit more about Britain's responsibility, but the thing that was interesting to me about the film, a lot of things. I mean, I mainly work in the black community, but I've organized, certainly I've organized white people against the war. I've organized white people for civil rights in the United States. And excuse me. During the 1960s, mainly middle class, but a lot of working class young white people supported the black movement, were against the war in Vietnam a lot because there was a draft. But the whole white world has moved to the right and moved to the most racist places where, Donald Trump got 62% of the white vote. And people said, oh, yeah, well, the women will try the white women because they're so alienated by his sexism, and 62% of the white women voted for Trump, proving that racism is the Trump card in the United States. So in your film, it opens with essentially a white mob attacking a bus of Syrian refugees, and Mata, who's the so the two protagonists are TJ, Tommy Joe Ballantyne, who's a bartender, and Mata, who's a Syrian refugee. And what's great about the film is that I do think organizing sometimes takes place when two people on the so-called other side get together and stand up to the white racists. And one more point is, I think those four guys in the bar, they were like the racist chorus, you know what I mean? Like they were the Greek chorus of representing the worst of the white psyche. So I like the film a lot. I like slow films, by the way. I like smaller films that move at a pace where you can enjoy every sentence. And, I thought it was very beautiful. Maybe Channing, you could say a few words too about the film.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with all of your thoughts just now. I also wish that the role of the Britain government was a little bit more in there. But I was affected on two fronts. I mean, one, I'm a trained photographer and I love photography, and so it's heartbreaking to see someone grab your camera out of it's weird. I'll say this. To start with, it's weird that as a photographer, you sometimes get a connection with this object, even though you can use any object to take pictures. But then it happens, right? And so to see her camera being grabbed, this precious thing that you make memories with, and that is your tool for revolution in some ways, be broken by white supremacy right in the beginning of the film is, I mean, that in itself is heartbreaking. And that paired with her sort of in some ways the whole film is sort of insecting the white psyche, but in particular when they go open up this room, the back room of the bar, it almost feels like sort of peeling back the layers and seeing sort of that full history that you're talking about, Ken, where they have these beautiful images of when this once was a bustling and hustling community. And at the same time, I think it's such an important scene because it starts to think about what is the white psyche in some ways and what happens so that, I don't know how to say this, but what ha why is it that it then defaults back to this racism when, things are not working correctly, right? And so I think there's a lot of nuance there that I think is really beautiful. The other piece, and I'll end with this piece, that I thought was really integral is this whole dynamic of mutual aid and feeding the community. And we, as part of our work, we do grocery giveaways every month as in Leimert Park. And you can see the effect of food and how it has an impact on people. And so even just introducing the idea of food and collective eating and bringing people together, that is the building of a group. That is, how do you then organize people in many ways? And so I thought that was a really integral and interesting piece as well.
But
Before
he's a
you go,
wonderful writer.
Ken, before you go, I just want to not go away. Everybody here on the Voices from the Front Lines on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, streaming live on the web at kpfk.org. Check out our website at voicesfromthefrontlines.com. And imagine a show where Ken's in England. This is the great Ken Loach. And please give money at 818-985-5735. We don't often do a lot of fundraising on the show. We should do more, but we're doing it now. So if you have this conversation with Channing Martinez, Ken Loach, and Eric Mann, I think it's priceless. So call 818-985-5735 and give as much money as you can so we can keep it priceless. Ken, why don't you respond, and thanks for waiting.
Oh, well, thank you for seeing the film and for sharing it again soon. I think one thing Paul and I thought was very important is that you see that the what turns into racism doesn't start as racism. It starts as a grievance that is justified. The people in the village have nothing. They have nothing. They haven't been consulted. They haven't been asked because the government decided on it, and the local council, which later became very supportive of the refugees, had little chance to organize anything. It was wished upon them. The women are saying, "Well, you could have told us, you could have told us." And there's one guy who's not from the village, but he's from Scotland. He's from elsewhere outside, and then he's the one. He's drunk too much, and he's the one who just plays a joke, which is a cruel joke, by using the camera to take his own pictures. And of course, he thinks he's being funny. He's actually being a nuisance, and then the camera breaks. But it begins. There's some justice in what they're saying. And then, and the subsequent scenes, we tried to show how that sense of we're being asked to share something when we have nothing, and there are richer areas who have plenty. Why don't they have refugees? They've got things to share. We've got nothing, and the working class is always exploited. This is typical. This is what they always do to us. And you can. There's a logic there, and then. But that turns into why they come to us to, well, we don't want them, to, we don't want you, to, we don't like you. We're entitled to keep our old poets, the only place we've got where we can gather. We want to keep the character the same. We don't want it to change. It's the one thing we've got from our past we can hang on to, which is understandable. But then to say, but then it turns into we won't welcome you, and gradually turns into racism. I mean, the one guy tends that way anyway, but it's not, this is not a racist village, but it becomes racist by having unreasonable things demanded of them and an easy scapegoat. And I think that understanding its roots, I think, is really important, because otherwise a lot of working class people will say, look, you're accusing us of all the racist. I mean, the middle class do that all the time. Ah, you're all racist. The working class are racist. The working class supported Brexit. The working class very right wing. The working class are cheated. Then they're presented with scapegoats. The right wing press encourages them to blame scapegoats. All the time there are stories about immigrants getting a house when local people have nothing. Immigrants getting money when local people are starving. Immigrants having jobs when local people have no work. I mean, there enough people fall for that. But we need to understand the roots of racism and where it can thrive. And the right wing understand that, because they don't want you to blame, of course, what we understand the real culprits, which is the system itself, the source of their exploitation and poverty. So racism has a function for the right wing, and how it can, why are these poor areas such fertile ground for racism is important to show. We felt that was really important to show. Mm-hmm. So that's the I guess the main thing about that. But the, and then of course it leads them into doing something which is cruel and silly. And one of the guys, the great friend that TJ has, who's a boy he grew up with, who was a minor alongside him, their parents, their fathers were great friends. They split, they have an argument, and the TJ's friend does something really appalling, for which he's confronted and is shamed. And at the end, and when there is a kind of, there's a tragedy happens to one of the Syrian families, and people do show solidarity. In the end, he comes round, really, but for his own self-respect, he's there, and doesn't make a thing of it. He won't show himself to others, but he's there. And Charlie's an important character in that, really. That development of racism, I think, was something we really felt was really important.
Well, Ken, let me make an alternate interpretation. We at the Strategy Center and we in the civil rights movement believe that the white people of all classes are inherently racist. They're not tricked by the ruling class. You know, for instance, Britain at one point controlled 80% of the world and inflicted horror. And yet the white working class, the white middle class, and the white upper class all went to Africa to kill Africans, all went to kill Indians. And at the time, they loved the crown, they loved the king, they love America. And, you know, England has fostered white settler states all over the world, starting with the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand. I think the white working class and the white middle class, whatever their contradiction is, they hate people of color. That's what I believe. And we've seen it. We've seen the white mobs who do not get won over. We've seen the Klan. And in the North, you know, Fannie Lou Hamer used to say, well, we're down south, but you're down north. And don't tell us how great things are in the North. So the way you portray it, Ken, is like, well, they were nice people until bad things happened to them. Our experiences is whether good things or bad things happen to white people, they have a lot of hatred and white supremacy in their soul. So we would go into that town and organize them, not around their economic interests, but to confront their moral I don't want to use too bad a word, but their moral degeneracy in some way, that your hatred of others, the hatred, the it's our country, what happened, why don't the middle class do it? Can't you find any common humanity? Can't you just say, hey, I got nothing going. I got some houses that are open. I hate the rich. How come they didn't march on the rich? They sit in the bar, you know, and they sit on the bar. This is our country. We've been screwed, but there's no class consciousness. So I just want to tell you that we just have a, I saw the film in a very favorable manner because of the transformative issues. But that white mob terrified me. And that white mob to me is the majority of white people.
I think we have very different experiences, really, of racism. I mean, my, you know, we've had, I guess, we have very comparable experiences, Eric, of, you know, 60 odd years in yep. Labour politics, of, and I think most, I mean, my dad was a, I mean, we were from a mining family, but I mean, being a filmmaker is inevitably that's not a working class life, really. I mean, your life is different, but we spent our lives active and with people and joining with people. And the majority of, I haven't found the, what you say. Undoubtedly, yes, there will be some people who have certainly developed a racism that seems automatic, whether it, I mean, learned, I guess. I mean, I wouldn't use the word instinctive, but there's a learned racism, which they go to fairly automatically now. And we've seen the right wing, you know, the fascists and neo-fascists and the far right using racism all the time, and the but the I'd resist your suggestion that it's absolutely implicit in people. That hasn't been our experience, I think. And I think it, of course, I mean, because his time has changed. I mean, we're not living in the, you know, the 16th, 17th, 18th century when people tolerated slavery, and in a way that was is unthinkable now, but the current working classes, as I've experienced them, don't. I wouldn't say that they are, by and large, implicitly racist. I think it.
Let me say this because I know Channing wants to say
the consequence of the political context.
Well, Ken, one thing I want to say is that we just talked about how people with different perspectives can work together. We chose your film because it's an anti-racist film. We chose your film because TJ represents the conscience of the white working class. He represents the best. He finds a common humanity. And one thing about Mara is she stands up to all these guys. I mean, for her to march into that bar and say, "Where's Rocco? I want him to fix my damn camera," is a great scene. So I just want to say that we don't have to agree on this. We can enjoy the conversation, but we want everybody to see your wonderful film, The Old Goat. And I just want to make sure Channing got a chance to say something, but you and I are comrades, Ken, and when we can have these conversations and continue to march,
absolutely.
Right? And march together.
Absolutely.
Last point I want to say, I mean, one, just a save your note. I just got a notification that students are walking out around school closure. So we'll talk about that in a minute. Two, I think, the thing that I love about it, though, I don't know, I think you kind of just said it, Eric, is that, you know, it takes Mara to come in to show them sort of revolution. And I think what supports the whole argument around the white psyche situation is it's not like she comes in with billions of dollars, right? I mean, all of that food comes from the community that's been there for years, right? And so it really took a conscious organizer to come in and say, have you guys forgotten? Have you guys lost your damn mind, to be quite frank? Have you forgotten who you are? And then, you know, as they have lost, you know, contact with the, you know, imperialist racist system, it takes her to then sort of remind people who they are. And so that's what I was trying to say in the beginning, is what happens to the white psyche when it's no longer attached to or is of use to imperialism? Why does it default to racism? Because I think the film shows that that is what happens. And then it takes, you know, quite frankly, this person of color to say, what the hell is going on here? What is wrong with you guys? And so that's one. And then the other thing I want to make sure, because we haven't said it yet, is that this is a sneak preview at Strategy. So, and it's also going to be shown the next day, which we'll be supporting at the Le Mille Royal the next day as well. So,
yeah, and one more thing, Ken, before I go. Our Voices listeners, you know, everything about this show is called Voices from the Frontlines. You got to go see the film. That's the point. I mean, Ken's on here and we're having a nice conversation, but he and Paul Haverty and Rebecca, they did a film. They worked very hard on this film. We love it. Obviously, Ken, if we didn't love it, we wouldn't be doing this. We want you to come to Strategy and Soul Thursday night. Go on our website and buy a ticket. I'm also going to try to go to the Royal because I got to support my friend Emily and support the Lemley people. So I don't want to do a sneak preview and then don't go. So if you come to ours, go to the Royal as well. But the point is, a lot of authors have said, when I'm on Voices from the Frontlines, more people buy my book. Filmmakers say, when I'm on Voices from the Frontlines, people go see the film. That's the point. So let's give a vote of confidence to Ken with a phenomenal career and turn out Thursday night, April 11th, and Friday at the Lemley Royal. Back to you, Ken.
Oh, well, that's very kind of you. But one other thing that I think I'm sure we would all three agree on is that the underpinning principle the politics I learned in the 60s, many things wrong in the groups I was with and bullying and God knows what went on. But the core of the politics we learned has stayed with many of us, and certainly with me. The core principle that's guided us from then on is this. The society is riven by class conflict, and there are two classes, those who sell their labor and those who profit from it. And that's the conflict. And it's irreconcilable until we win. And whatever form it takes, whatever tactics are used, that's the guiding light. I've worked with a wonderful writer before, Paul, called Jim Allen, who wrote to Land and Freedom, by the way. Wonderful, wonderful writer. He'd been a building worker, he'd been a dock worker, he'd been a miner, and he used to join building sites to recruit people to union and then get slung off and go somewhere else. Jack London was one of his writing heroes. A great man. And he said, wrote wonderful lines. One of his lines was, "Social Democrats always betray." And that's been one of the curses, I'm sure we'd all agree, of the labor movement. That is, people who talk left, but in the end, support the continuation of capitalism, of production for private profit, who in the end have to support the exploitation of the working class because they need big corporates to make money so they can pay their taxes, so they can pay for public services. But their priority is profit for private industry. And that's why they always betray. And it's only whether we are called socialists or we call communists or whatever, that's the guiding principle, fundamental class conflict, and everything springs from that. And I think that's, if we say Jim called it the map and compass as a guide, and the fundamental conflict in our society is class. And if we, I think if we stick with that, we won't go far wrong.
Well, I think what you just said is like, I think everybody has to have a worldview they can say in one sentence. If you don't know your worldview in one sentence, you don't have one. So your worldview is that, at the end of the day, it's the class struggle between the two classes. Very nicely said. So you're listening again to Ken Loach. You can go on, what do you call it? They call it filmography. How many films have you made, Ken, all together?
Oh, God, I don't know. First one was in 1963, but I worked for television for quite a long time. 1980s, I did practically nothing. Couldn't direct traffic, as they said at the time. And so it's, I don't know, I think not all cinema films, I think probably about 30 cinema films or so, but about, it depends what you count, include documentaries, 50 or 60, I suppose. I haven't counted them up, Eric, to be honest. It's good.
You're pretty good. I mean, whether
too many, some would say.
No. Don't do that. I mean, legacy, you know, I'm 81. I'm working on my own legacy. And my wife, Leanne, helps me. We find amazing. We just found the minutes of the first meeting of the Congress of Racial Equality.
Oh.
Where I was hired as a field secretary in September of 1964. So your legacy, you know, and I want to say with people our age, they always talk about your legacy like you did. I mean, we want to enjoy our legacy while we're alive. And to say you've done 50 or 60 films, congratulations, Ken. I mean, what a brilliant life work that there's no way I can express my full admiration for everything you've done. And
That's very kind of you. I have to say that there's a few I'd rather you didn't see, Eric, I have to say. I'm not going to tell you which they are, but there's a few you should avoid. Real stinkers. I mean, but you learn from your mistakes, don't you, really? I hope, anyway.
I do, yes.
Yeah.
Last couple of thoughts. Tell us about the relationship with you and Paul. How do you work together? What are the dynamics? Does he bring an initial script to you and you talk about it?
We're great mates. I mean, he was a lawyer, and then he went to Nicaragua as a human rights observer in the Contra War, was in the front line, pretty close to the front line, documenting the Contra terrorist activities.
Came back and
dropped me a letter, and we met and immediately became pals, and we've worked together for over 30 years now, and we're in touch most days, either a text or a conversation every second day now. He lives in Scotland, I'm in the southwest of England, and it's about everything, obviously, often mainly about public events, what's going on in the world, the family stuff. It's about things that catch your eye. Have you read this? Have you seen that? Read this article. Here's a little interview you might enjoy. I mean, it's him to me, because I'm crap with the new technology, you know, and my eyesight's rubbish, so I'm a hindrance to him now. But so he sends a lot of that, a lot of football, because we both follow the football very closely, and so there's as much football as anything else. I mean, there's many things. I mean, he's a lovely man, generous, funny, lovely man. You should interview him sometime, because so much to say, and great contributions. What's interesting about him is, because he's a generation younger than me, well, he's 20 odd years younger. I mean, he didn't grow up with the same I mean, my radicalism, socialism comes from witnessing and being part of and standing alongside the others on the picket line, industrial disputes. Paul's came from internationalism, from going to Nicaragua. He learned Spanish there, and his wife is a wonderful film director called Ithiel Bayen. And he speaks Spanish. So his internationalism is much more sophisticated and precise than mine. So that's important. But as regards working together, after this superb conversation, there'll be one story that would catch your eye and say, and we talk about it back and forth, and then the idea, is there a film in that? And then we'd meet and we'd talk, and then Paul would write, say, a couple of characters, and we'd talk about that. Do they contain the contradictions and the conflict that will allow if we just tell that story, will that illuminate everything we want to say and go to the heart, the very heart of what we want to say?
I just wanted to say, Ken, that what you did with Mara and TJ, that's what I wrote in my review, that they both embodied the theory. I mean, that was what was so brilliant, is that those two protagonists, their relationship, you know, just when he sees them break her camera, and he says, well, I have some cameras, and let me go find a new camera, and he brings it to her. That's the revolution in some way. That is the revolution. Yeah. You know, it's the kindness. So you and Paul did great in terms of character development. At the end, we call it, this is the last word, Ken. We, as always, we always say it'd be 30 minutes, but we never stop. So it's been almost 55. Channing, you get the last word. And then you get the last word, Ken, and then I get the last word. How's that?
Okay.
So, Channing?
Just to finish but Paul, those characters are Paul's. I have to say that, you know, to be fair to our partnership. And Paul then writes it on his own. He writes the first draft, and then we knock it backwards and forwards. But Paul comes around when we're casting. He comes in when we're shooting as often as he can. If he chats to the people, but we're very respectful of the director's work, as I'm respectful of the writer's work. But we talk about everything, and it's the easiest relationship in the world. But I think as a last word, I think one little quote that comes to mind, which I think, again, sums up the film and sums up our, I think, again, what we would have in common, was the quotation from a famous priest, and I forget his name, but somebody will remember it, who said, when I give food to the poor, they call me a saint. When I ask why the poor have no food, they call me a communist. And I think that's where we stand. You know, social justice, human rights, respect for international law, and we won't go far wrong. Anyway, great to talk to you, Eric, and Tommy too. So thanks a lot, and solidarity.
Solidarity, brother. We want you to have the last word. I don't want a last word. I want to make sure that's the last word.
Absolutely.
We'll be in touch, Ken. Much love to you. We're going to really kick it to get people to see the Old Oak. I hope it's a week from Thursday. This is Friday morning, so you only got one more week. We already put out flyers, and we'll be there, and we're going to do right by you.
Thanks so much.
Take care, brother.
Well, you heard them both. Thursday night, April 11th at Strategy and Soul. Thursday night, Strategy and Soul Revolutionary Organizing Film Club. And the Old Oak really is about revolutionary organizing in the age of reaction. If you want to learn more information about this, you can always visit www.voicesfromthefrontlines.com or thestrategycenter.org. And I just want to remind you to call 818-985-5735. donate to KPFK today to make sure that shows like Voices from the Frontlines can continue to be on air. As you know, in many revolutionary moments in history, radio and even leaflets were contraband. And in LA, you know, KPFK is one of the few radio stations talking about the frontline struggles from Palestine to South LA to even England and Great Britain and beyond. And we want to make sure that KPFK continues to be able to make sure the movement has a voice always. So call 818-985-5735. Earlier on the show, I mentioned school closures, and that's because I got an Instagram notification that students at Morningside High School actually just walked out on Wednesday, the 3rd, and that's because Inglewood Schools are saying that they're going to be closing about 4 or 5 schools. I had to look up more information to fully understand, but apparently the Inglewood School District, which is still about 32.9, so 33% Black, majority Black, right, is threatening to close schools, and they've been in receivership, state receivership, since 2012, and there's a long document going into details that I'm not going to talk about, talking about how they can't afford schools. And I see that and I'm shocked because the new stadium just opened and this whole theme park just opened, and it just goes back to why you should join the Bus Riders Union and learn more about how Metro in particular, but yes, as an extension, Mayor Butts and a lot of the municipal cities are, you know, on the Metro board playing politics with people's lives. How is it that you can afford to open up a big studio and stadium, an entertainment theme park in the middle of Inglewood, at the same time that they're threatening to close Black and Latinx schools? It makes absolutely no sense. You can learn more about the Bus Riders Union at thestrategycenter.org. As always, as Nina says, we did it our way. We're always going to do it our way. Thank goodness for Nina Simone. We want to hear from you. You can email either myself, Channing, or Eric at voicesfromthefrontlines.com with your commentaries and responses from the show. You can always tweet us as well at Eric Mann Speaks, or on Instagram, send us a message at Voices from the Frontlines. And if you want to hear this show and other shows, go to voicesfromthefrontlines.com or look up our name on your favorite podcasting site and it should pop up. And if we are not on your site, email me and we will be on your site. And with that, I look forward to hearing from you by next week, and you'll hear from me and Eric by next week. Power to the people.